During that reading, the top part of my mind is concentrating on story and toolbox concerns, knocking out pronouns with unclear antecedents. I hate and mistrust pronouns, every one of them as slippery as a fly-by-night personal injury lawyer. Adding, clarifying phrases where they seem necessary, and, of course, deleting all the adverbs I can bear to part with. Never all of them, never enough. Underneath, however, I'm asking myself the big questions. The biggest, is this story coherent? And if it is, what will turn coherence into a song? What are the recurring elements? Do they entwine and make a theme? I'm asking myself, what's it all about, Stevie, in other words, and what I can do to make those underlying concerns even clearer. What I want most of all is resonance, something that will linger for a little while in constant reader's mind and heart after he or she has closed the book and put it up on the shelf. I'm looking for ways to do that without spoon-feeding the reader or selling my birthright for a plot of message. Take all those messages and those morals and stick 'em where the sun don't shine, all right? I want resonance. Most of all, I'm looking for what I meant, because in the second draft, I'll want to add scenes and incidents that reinforce that meaning. I'll also want to delete stuff that goes in other directions. There's apt to be a lot of that stuff, especially near the beginning of a story when I have a tendency to flail. All that thrashing around has to go if I am to achieve anything like a unified effect. When I've finished reading and making all my little anal retentive revisions, it's time to open the door and show what I've written to 4 or 5 close friends who have indicated a willingness to look. Someone, I can't remember who for the life of me, once wrote that all novels are really letters aimed at one person. As it happens, I believe this. I think that every novelist has a single ideal reader, that at various points during the composition of a story, the writer is thinking, I wonder what he or she will think when he or she reads this part. For me, that first reader is my wife, Tabitha. She has always been an extremely sympathetic and supportive first reader. Her positive reaction to difficult books like Bag of Bones, my first novel with a new publisher after 20 good years with Viking, that came to an end in a stupid squabble about money, and relatively controversial ones like Gerald's Game, meant the world to me. But she's also unflinching when she sees something she thinks is wrong. When she does, she lets me know loud and clear. In her role as critic and first reader, Tabby often makes me think of a story I read about Alfred Hitchcock's wife, Alma Reville. Ms. Reville was the equivalent of Hitch's first reader, a sharp-eyed critic who was totally unimpressed with the suspense master's growing reputation as an auteur. Lucky for him, Hitch say he want to fly. Alma say, first, eat your eggs. Not long after finishing Psycho, Hitchcock screened it for a few friends. They raved about it, declaring it to be a suspense masterpiece. Alma was quiet until they'd all had their say, then spoke very firmly. You can't send it out like that. There was a thunderstruck silence except for Hitchcock himself, who only asked why not. Because, his wife responded, Janet Leigh swallows when she's supposed to be dead. It was true. Hitchcock didn't argue any more than I do when Tabby points out one of my lapses. She and I may argue about many aspects of a book, and there have been times when I've gone against her judgment on subjective matters, but when she catches me in a goof, I know it, and thank God I've got someone around who'll tell me my fly's unzipped before I go out in public that way. In addition to Tabby's first read, I usually send manuscripts to between 4 and 8 other people who have critiqued my stories over the years. Many writing texts caution against asking friends to read your stuff, suggesting you're not apt to get a very unbiased opinion from folks who've eaten dinner at your house and sent their kids over to play with your kids in your backyard. It's unfair, according to this view, to put a pal in such a position. What happens if he or she feels he or she has to say, I'm sorry, good buddy. You've written some great yarns in the past, but this one sucks like a vacuum cleaner. The idea has some validity, but I don't think an unbiased opinion is exactly what I'm looking for. And I believe that most people smart enough to read a novel are also tactful enough to find a gentler mode of expression than "this sucks." Although most of us know that "I think this has a few problems" actually means "this sucks," don't we? Besides, if you really did write a stinker, it happens. As the author of Maximum Overdrive, I'm qualified to say so. Wouldn't you rather hear the news from a friend while the entire edition consists of half a dozen Xerox copies? When you give out 6 or 8 copies of a book, you get back 6 or 8 highly subjective opinions about what's good and what's bad in it. If all your readers think you did a pretty good job, you probably did. This sort of unanimity does happen, but it's rare, even with friends. More likely, they'll think that some parts are good and some parts are, well, not so good. Some will feel character A works, but character B is far-fetched. If others feel that character B is believable, but character A is overdrawn, it's a wash. You can safely relax and leave things the way they are. In baseball, tie goes to the runner. For novelists, it goes to the writer. If some people love your ending and others hate it, same deal. It's a wash, and tie goes to the writer. Some first readers specialize in pointing out factual errors, which are the easiest to deal with. One of my first reader smart guys, the late Mac McCutcheon, a wonderful high school English teacher, knew a lot about guns. If I had a character toting a Winchester 330, Mac might jot in the margin that Winchester didn't make that caliber, but Remington did. In such cases, you've got 2 for the price of 1, the error and the fix. It's a good deal because you come off looking like you're an expert, and your first reader will feel flattered to have been of help. And the best catch Mac ever made for me had nothing to do with guns. One day, while reading a piece of a manuscript in the teacher's room, he burst out laughing, laughed so hard, in fact, that tears went rolling down his bearded cheeks. Because the story in question, Salem's Lot, had not been intended as a laugh riot, I asked him what he had found. I had written a line that went something like this: "Although deer season doesn't start until November in Maine, the fields of October are often alive with gunshots. The locals are shooting as many peasants as they think their families will eat." A copy editor would no doubt have picked up the mistake, but Mac spared me that embarrassment. I had meant, of course, pheasants. Subjective evaluations are, as I say, a little harder to deal with. But listen, if everyone who reads your book says you have a problem, Connie comes back to her husband too easily, Hal's cheating on the big exam seems unrealistic given what we know about him, the novel's conclusion seems abrupt and arbitrary, you've got a problem, and you better do something about it. Plenty of writers resist this idea. They feel that revising a story according to the likes and dislikes of an audience is somehow akin to prostitution. If you really feel that way, I won't try to change your mind. You'll save on charges at CopyCop, too, because you won't have to show anyone your story in the first place. In fact, he said snottily, if you really feel that way, why bother to publish at all? Just finish your books and then pop them in a safe deposit box, as J.D. Salinger is reputed to have been doing in his later years. And yes, I can relate, at least a bit, to that sort of resentment. In the film business, where I have had a quasi-professional life, first draft showings are called test screenings. These have become standard practice in the industry, and they drive most filmmakers absolutely bugshit. Maybe they should. The studio shells out somewhere between $15 and $100 million to make a film, then asks the director to recut it based on the opinions of a Santa Barbara multiplex audience composed of hairdressers, meter maids, shoe store clerks, and out-of-work pizza delivery guys. And the worst, most maddening thing about it? If you get the demographic right, test screenings seem to work. I'd hate to see novels revised on the basis of test audiences. A lot of good books would never see the light of day if it was done that way. But come on, we're talking about half a dozen people you know and respect. If you ask the right ones, and if they agree to read your book, they can tell you a lot. Do all opinions weigh the same? Not for me. In the end, I listen most closely to Tabby because she's the one I write for, the one I want to wow. If you're writing primarily for one person besides yourself, I'd advise you to pay very close attention to that person's opinion. I know one fellow who says he writes mostly for someone who's been dead 15 years, but the majority of us aren't in that position. And if what you hear makes sense, then make the changes. You can't let the whole world into your story, but you can let in the ones that matter the most, and you should. Call that one person you write for ideal reader. He or she is going to be in your writing room all the time, in the flesh once you open the door and let the world back in to shine on the bubble of your dream, in spirit during the sometimes troubling and often exhilarating days of the first draft when the door is closed. And you know what? You'll find yourself bending the story even before ideal reader glimpses so much as the first sentence. IR will help you get outside yourself a little to actually read your work in progress as an audience would while you're still working. This is perhaps the best way of all to make sure you stick to story, a way of playing to the audience even while there's no audience there and you're totally in charge. When I write a scene that strikes me as funny, like the pie-eating contest in The Body or the execution rehearsal in The Green Mile, I am also imagining my IR finding it funny. I love it when Tabby laughs out of control. She puts her hands up as if to say, "I surrender," and these big tears go rolling down her cheeks. I love it, that's all. I fucking adore it. And when I get hold of something with that potential, I twist it as hard as I can. During the actual writing of such a scene, door closed, the thought of making her laugh or cry is in the back of my mind. During the rewrite, door open, the question, is it funny enough yet, scary enough, is right up front. I try to watch her when she gets to a particular scene, hoping for at least a smile or, jackpot, baby, that big belly laugh with the hands up waving in the air. This isn't always easy on her. I gave her the manuscript of my novella, Hearts in Atlantis, while we were in North Carolina, where we'd gone to see a Cleveland Rockers Charlotte Sting WNBA game. We drove north to Virginia the following day, and it was during this drive that Tabby read my story. There are some funny parts in it, at least I thought so, and I kept peeking over at her to see if she was chuckling or at least smiling. I didn't think she'd notice, but of course she did. On my 8th or 9th peek, I guess it could have been my 15th, she looked up and snapped, "Pay attention to your driving before you crack us up, will you? Stop being so goddamn needy." I paid attention to my driving and stopped sneaking peeks. Well, almost. About 5 minutes later, I heard a snort of laughter from my right. Just a little one, but it was enough for me. The truth is that most writers are needy, especially between the first draft and the second, when the study door swings open and the light of the world shines in. Ideal reader is also the best way for you to gauge whether or not your story is paced correctly and if you've handled the backstory in satisfactory fashion. Pace is the speed at which your narrative unfolds. There is a kind of unspoken, hence undefended and unexamined, belief in publishing circles that the most commercially successful stories and novels are fast-paced. I guess the underlying thought is that people have so many things to do today and are so easily distracted from the printed word that you'll lose them unless you become a kind of short-order cook, serving up sizzling burgers, fries, and eggs over easy just as fast as you can. Like so many unexamined beliefs in the publishing business, this idea is largely bullshit, which is why when books like Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose or Charles Frazier's Cold Mountain suddenly break out of the pack and climb the bestseller lists, publishers and editors are astonished. I suspect that most of them ascribe these books' unexpected success to unpredictable and deplorable lapses into good taste on the part of the reading public. Not that there's anything wrong with rapidly paced novels. Some pretty good writers, Nelson DeMille, Wilbur Smith, and Sue Grafton, to name just three, have made millions writing them. But you can overdo the speed thing. Move too fast and you risk leaving the reader behind, either by confusing or by wearing him or her out. And for myself, I like a slower pace and a bigger, higher build. The leisurely luxury liner experience of a long, absorbing novel like The Far Pavilions or A Suitable Boy has been one of the form's chief attractions since the first examples, endless, multi-part epistolary tales like Clarissa. I believe each story should be allowed to unfold at its own pace, and that pace is not always double time. Nevertheless, you need to beware. If you slow the pace down too much, even the most patient reader is apt to grow restive. The best way to find the happy medium? Ideal reader, of course. Try to imagine whether he or she will be bored by a certain scene. If you know the tastes of your IR even half as well as I know the tastes of mine, that shouldn't be too hard. Is IR going to feel this too much pointless talk in this place or that? That you've underexplained a certain situation or overexplained it, which is one of my chronic failings? That you forgot to resolve some important plot point? Forgot an entire character, as Raymond Chandler once did? When asked about the murdered chauffeur in The Big Sleep, Chandler, who liked his tipple, replied, "Oh, him. You know, I forgot all about him." These questions should be in your mind even with the door closed. And once it's open, once your ideal reader has actually read your manuscript, you should ask your questions out loud. Also, needy or not, you might want to watch and see when your IR puts your manuscript down to do something else. What scene was he or she reading? What was so easy to put down? Mostly, when I think of pacing, I go back to Elmore Leonard, who explained it so perfectly by saying he just left out the boring parts. This suggests cutting to speed the pace, and that's what most of us end up having to do. Kill your darlings, even when it breaks your egocentric little scribbler's heart. Kill your darlings. As a teenager, sending out stories to magazines like Fantasy and Science Fiction and Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, I got used to the sort of rejection note that starts, "Dear contributor," might as well start off, "Dear chump," and so came to relish any little personal dash on these printed pink slips. They were few and far between, but when they came, they never failed to lighten my day and put a smile on my face. In the spring of my senior year at Lisbon High, 1966 this would have been, I got a scribbled comment that changed the way I rewrote my fiction once and forever. Jotted below the machine-generated signature of the editor was this motto: "Not bad, but puffy. You need to revise for length. Formula, second draft equal first draft minus 10%. Good luck." I wish I could remember who wrote that note. Algis Budrys, perhaps. Whoever it was did me a hell of a favor. I copied the formula out on a piece of shirt cardboard and taped it to the wall beside my typewriter. Good things started to happen for me shortly after. There was no sudden golden flood of magazine sales, but the number of personal notes on the rejection slips went up fast. I even got one from Durant Imboden, the fiction editor at Playboy. That communique almost stopped my heart. Playboy paid $2,000 and up for short stories, and $2,000 was a quarter of what my mother made each year in her housekeeping job at Pineland Training Center. The rewrite formula probably wasn't the only reason I started to get some results. I suspect another was that it was just my time coming around at last, sort of like Yeats's Rough Beast. Still, the formula was surely part of it. Before the formula, if I produced a story that was 4,000 words or so in first draft, it was apt to be 5,000 in second. Some writers are taker-outers. I'm afraid I've always been a natural putter-inner. After the formula, that changed. Even today, I will aim for a second draft length of 3,600 words if the first draft of a story ran 4,000. And if the first draft of a novel runs 350,000 words, I'll try my damnedest to produce a second draft of no more than 315,000, 300 if possible. Usually, it is possible. What the formula taught me is that every story and novel is collapsible to some degree. If you can't get out 10% of it while retaining the basic story and flavor, you're not trying very hard. The effect of judicious cutting is immediate and often amazing. Literary Viagra. You'll feel it, and your IR will, too. Backstory is all the stuff that happened before your tale began, but which has an impact on the front story. Backstory helps define character and establish motivation. I think it's important to get the backstory in as quickly as possible, but it's also important to do it with some grace. As an example of what's not graceful, consider this line of dialogue. "Hello, ex-wife," Tom said to Doris as she entered the room. Now, it may be important to the story that Tom and Doris are divorced, but there has to be a better way to do it than the above, which is about as graceful as an axe murder. Here is one suggestion. "Hi, Doris," Tom said. His voice sounded natural enough, to his own ears at least, but the fingers of his right hand crept to the place where his wedding ring had been until 6 months ago. Still no Pulitzer winner, and quite a bit longer than "Hello, ex-wife," but it's not all about speed, as I've already tried to point out. And if you think it's all about information, you ought to give up fiction and get a job writing instruction manuals. Dilbert's cubicle awaits. You've probably heard the phrase in medias res, which means into the midst of things. This technique is an ancient and honorable one, but I don't like it. In medias res necessitates flashbacks, which strike me as boring and sort of corny. They always make me think of those movies from the 40s and 50s where the picture gets all swimmy, the voice gets all echoey, and suddenly it's 16 months ago and the mud-splashed convict we just saw trying to outrun the bloodhounds is an up-and-coming young lawyer who hasn't yet been framed for the murder of the crooked police chief. As a reader, I'm a lot more interested in what's going to happen than what already did. Yes, there are brilliant novels that run counter to this preference, or maybe it's a prejudice. Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier for one, A Dark Adapted Eye by Barbara Vine for another. But I like to start at square one, dead even with the writer. I'm an A to Z man. Serve me the appetizer first and give me dessert if I eat my veggies. Even when you tell your story in this straightforward manner, you'll discover you can't escape at least some backstory. In a very real sense, every life is in medias res. If you introduce a 40-year-old man as your main character on page one of your novel, and if the action begins as a result of some brand new person or situations exploding onto the stage of this fellow's life, a road accident, let's say, or doing a favor for a beautiful woman who keeps looking sexily back over her shoulder. Did you notice the awful adverb in this sentence, which I could not bring myself to kill? You'll still have to deal with the first 40 years of the guy's life at some point. How much and how well you deal with those years will have a lot to do with the level of success your story achieves, with whether readers think of it as a good read or a big fat bore. Probably J.K. Rowling, author of the Harry Potter stories, is the current champ when it comes to backstory. You could do worse than read these, noting how effortlessly each new book recaps what has gone before. Also, the Harry Potter novels are just fun, pure story from beginning to end. Your ideal reader can be of tremendous help when it comes to figuring out how well you did with the backstory and how much you should add or subtract on your next draft. You need to listen very carefully to the things IR didn't understand and then ask yourself if you understand them. If you do and just didn't put those parts across, your job on the second draft is to clarify. If you don't, if the parts of the backstory your ideal reader queried are hazy to you as well, then you need to think a lot more carefully about the past events that cast a light on your character's present behavior. You also need to pay close attention to those things in the backstory that bored your ideal reader. In Bag of Bones, for instance, main character Mike Noonan is a 40-ish writer who, as the book opens, has just lost his wife to a brain aneurysm. We start on the day of her death, but there's still a hell of a lot of backstory here, much more than I usually have in my fiction. This includes Mike's first job as a newspaper reporter, the sale of his first novel, his relations with his late wife's sprawling family, his publishing history, and especially the matter of their summer home in Western Maine, how they came to buy it, and some of its pre-Mike and Johanna history. Tabitha, my IR, read all this with apparent enjoyment, but there was also a 2- or 3-page section about Mike's community service work in the year after his wife dies, a year in which his grief is magnified by a severe case of writer's block. Tabby didn't like the community service stuff. "Who cares?" she asked me. "I want to know more about his bad dreams, not how he ran for city council in order to help get the homeless alcoholics off the street." "Yeah, but he's got writer's block," I said. When a novelist is challenged on something he likes, one of his darlings, the first two words out of his mouth are almost always, "Yeah, but." This block goes on for a year, maybe more. He has to do something in all that time, doesn't he? "I guess so," Tabby said, "but you don't have to bore me with it, do you?" Ouch. Game, set, and match. Like most good IRs, Tabby can be ruthless when she's right. I cut down Mike's charitable contributions and community functions from 2 pages to 2 paragraphs. It turned out that Tabby was right. As soon as I saw it in print, I knew. 3 million people or so have read Bag of Bones. I've gotten at least 4,000 letters concerning it, and so far not a single one has said, "Hey, Turkey, what was Mike doing for community service work during the year he couldn't write?" The most important things to remember about backstory are that A, everyone has a history, and B, most of it isn't very interesting. Stick to the parts that are, and don't get carried away with the rest. Long life stories are best received in bars, and only then, an hour or so before closing time, and if you are buying. We need to talk a bit about research, which is a specialized kind of backstory. And please, if you do need to do research because parts of your story deal with things about which you know little or nothing, remember that word back. That's where research belongs, as far in the background and the backstory as you can get it. You may be entranced with what you're learning about flesh-eating bacteria, the sewer system of New York, or the IQ potential of collie pups, but your readers are probably going to care a lot more about your characters and your story. Exceptions to the rule? Sure, aren't there always? There have been very successful writers, Arthur Haley and James Michener are the first ones that come to my mind, whose novels rely heavily on fact and research. Haley's are barely disguised manuals about how things work, banks, airports, hotels, and Michener's are combination travelogues, geography lessons, and history texts. Other popular writers, like Tom Clancy and Patricia Cornwell, are more story-oriented but still deliver large, and sometimes hard to digest, dollops of factual information along with the melodrama. I sometimes think that these writers appeal to a large segment of the reading population who feel that fiction is somehow immoral, a low taste, which can only be justified by saying, "Well, yes, I do read," fill in author's name here, "but only on airplanes and in hotel rooms that don't have CNN. Also, I learned a great deal about," fill in appropriate subject here. For every successful writer of the factoid type, however, there are 100, perhaps even 1,000, wannabes, some published, most not. On the whole, I think story belongs in front, but some research is inevitable. You shirk it at your peril. In the spring of 1999, I drove from Florida, where my wife and I had wintered, back to Maine. My second day on the road, I stopped for gas at a little station just off the Pennsylvania Turnpike, one of those amusingly antique places where a fellow still comes out, pumps your gas, and asks you how you're doing and who you like in the NCAA tournament. I told this one I was doing fine and liked Duke in the tournament. Then I went around back to use the men's room. There was a brawling stream full of snowmelt beyond the station, and when I came out of the men's, I walked a little way down the slope, which was littered with cast-off tire rims and engine parts, for a closer look at the water. There were still patches of snow on the ground. I slipped on one and started to slide down the embankment. I grabbed a piece of someone's old engine block and stopped myself before I got fairly started, but I realized as I got up that if I'd fallen just right, I could have slid all the way down into that stream and been swept away. I found myself wondering, had that happened, how long it would have taken the gas station attendant to call the state police if my car, a brand new Lincoln Navigator, just continued to stand there in front of the pumps. By the time I got back on the turnpike again, I had two things, a wet ass from my fall behind the mobile station and a great idea for a story. In it, a mysterious man in a black coat, likely not a human being at all, but some creature inexpertly disguised to look like one, abandons his vehicle in front of a small gas station in rural Pennsylvania. The vehicle looks like an old Buick Special from the late 50s, but it's no more a Buick than the guy in the black coat was a human being. The vehicle falls into the hands of some state police officers working out of a fictional barracks in western Pennsylvania. 20 years or so later, these cops tell the story of the Buick to the grief-stricken son of a state policeman who has been killed in the line of duty. It was a grand idea and has developed into a strong novel about how we hand down our knowledge and our secrets. It's also a grim and frightening story about an alien piece of machinery that sometimes reaches out and swallows people whole. Of course, there were a few minor problems. The fact that I knew absolutely zilch about the Pennsylvania State Police, for one thing. But I didn't let any of that bother me. I simply made up the stuff I didn't know. I could do that because I was writing with the door shut, writing only for myself and the ideal reader in my mind. My mental version of Tabby is rarely as prickly as my real-life wife can be. In my daydreams, she usually applauds and urges me ever onward with shining eyes. One of my most memorable sessions took place in a fourth-floor room of Boston's Elliott Hotel. Me sitting at the desk by the window, writing about an autopsy on an alien bat creature, while the Boston Marathon flowed exuberantly by just below me, and rooftop boomboxes blasted out dirty water by the Standells. There were 1,000 people down there below me in the streets, but not a single one in my room to be a party pooper and tell me I got this detail wrong or the cops don't do things that way in western Pennsylvania, so nyah, nyah, nyah. The novel, it's called From a Buick 8, has been set aside in a desk drawer since late May of 1999 when the first draft was finished. Work on it has been delayed by circumstances beyond my control, but eventually I hope and expect to spend a couple of weeks in western Pennsylvania, where I've been given conditional permission to do some ride-alongs with the state police. The condition, which seems eminently reasonable to me, was that I not make them look like meanies, maniacs, or idiots. Once I've done that, I should be able to correct the worst of my howlers and add some really nice detail work. Not much, though. Research is backstory, and the key word in backstory is back. The tale I have to tell in Buick 8 has to do with monsters and secrets. It is not a story about police procedure in western Pennsylvania. What I'm looking for is nothing but a touch of verisimilitude, like the handful of spices you chuck into a good spaghetti sauce to really finish her off. That sense of reality is important in any work of fiction, but I think it is particularly important in a story dealing with the abnormal or paranormal. Also, enough details, always assuming they are the correct ones, can stem the tide of letters from picky-ass readers who apparently live to tell writers that they messed up. The tone of these letters is unvaryingly gleeful. When you step away from the write-what-you-know rule, research becomes inevitable, and it can add a lot to your story, just Don't end up with the tail wagging the dog. Remember that you are writing a novel, not a research paper. The story always comes first. I think even James Michener and Arthur Haley would have agreed with that. I'm often asked if I think the beginning writer of fiction can benefit from writing classes or seminars. The people who ask are, all too often, looking for a magic bullet or a secret ingredient or possibly Dumbo's magic feather, none of which can be found in classrooms or at writing retreats, no matter how enticing the brochures may be. As for myself, I'm doubtful about writing classes, but not entirely against them. In T. Caressen Boyle's wonderful tragicomic novel, East is East, there is a description of a writer's colony in the woods that struck me as fairy tale perfect. Each attendee has his or her own little cabin where he or she supposedly spends the day writing. At noon, a waiter from the main lodge brings these fledgling Hemingways and Cathers a box lunch and puts it on the front stoop of the cottage. Very quietly puts it on the stoop, so as not to disturb the creative trance of the cabin's occupant. One room of each cabin is the writing room. In the other is a cot for that all-important afternoon nap, or perhaps for a revivifying bounce with one of the other attendees. In the evening, all members of the colony gather in the lodge for dinner and intoxicating conversation with the writers in residence. Later, before a roaring fire in the parlor, marshmallows are toasted, popcorn is popped, wine is drunk, and the stories of the colony attendees are read aloud and then critiqued. To me, this sounded like an absolutely enchanted writing environment. I especially liked the part about having your lunch left at the front door, deposited there as quietly as the tooth fairy deposits a quarter under a kid's pillow. I imagine it appealed because it's so far from my own experience, where the creative flow is apt to be stopped at any moment by a message from my wife that the toilet is plugged up and would I try to fix it, or a call from the office telling me that I'm in imminent danger of blowing yet another dental appointment. At times like that, I'm sure all writers feel pretty much the same, no matter what their skill and success level. God, if only I were in the right writing environment, with the right understanding people, I just know I could be penning my masterpiece. In truth, I've found that any day's routine interruptions and distractions don't much hurt a work in progress and may actually help it in some ways. It is, after all, the dab of grit that seeps into an oyster shell that makes the pearl, not pearl-making seminars with other oysters. And the larger the work looms in my day, the more it seems like an I have to instead of just an I wanna, the more problematic it can become. One serious problem with writers' workshops is that I have to becomes the rule. You didn't come, after all, to wander lonely as a cloud, experiencing the beauty of the woods or the grandeur of the mountains. You're supposed to be writing, damn it, if only so that your colleagues will have something to critique as they toast their goddamn marshmallows there in the main lodge. When, on the other hand, making sure the kid gets to his basketball camp on time is every bit as important as your work in progress, there's a lot less pressure to produce. And what about those critiques, by the way? How valuable are they? Not very, in my experience. Sorry. A lot of them are maddeningly vague. I love the feeling of Peter's stories, someone may say. It has something, a sense of, I don't know, there's a loving kind of, you know, I can't exactly describe it. Other writing seminar jimmies include, I felt like the tone thing was just kind of, you know. The character of Polly seemed pretty much stereotypical. I loved the imagery because I could see what he was talking about more or less perfectly. And instead of pelting these babbling idiots with their own freshly toasted marshmallows, everyone else sitting around the fire is often nodding and smiling and looking solemnly thoughtful. In too many cases, the teachers and writers in residence are nodding, smiling, and looking solemnly thoughtful right along with them. It seems to occur to few of the attendees that if you have a feeling you just can't describe, you might just be, I don't know, kind of like my sense of it is maybe in the wrong fucking class. Nonspecific critiques won't help when you sit down to your second draft and may hurt. Certainly, none of the comments above touch on the language of your piece or its narrative sense. These comments are just wind, offering no factual input at all. Also, daily critiques force you to write with the door constantly open, and in my mind, that sort of defeats the purpose. What good does it do you to have a waiter tiptoe soundlessly up to the stoop of your cabin with your lunch and then tiptoe away with equal solicitous soundlessness if you are reading your current work aloud every night or handing it out on Xerox sheets to a group of would-be writers who are telling you they like the way you handle tone and mood but want to know if Dolly's cap, the one with the bells on it, is symbolic? The pressure to explain is always on, and a lot of your creative energy, it seems to me, is therefore going in the wrong direction. You find yourself constantly questioning your prose and your purpose when what you should probably be doing is writing as fast as the gingerbread man runs, getting that first draft down on paper while the shape of the fossil is still bright and clear in your mind. Too many writing classes make, wait a minute, explain what you meant by that, a kind of bylaw. In all fairness, I must admit to a certain prejudice here. One of the few times I suffered a full-fledged case of writer's block was during my senior year at the University of Maine, when I was taking not one but two creative writing courses. One was the seminar in which I met my future wife, so it can hardly be counted as a dead loss. Most of my fellow students that semester were writing poems about sexual yearning or stories in which moody young men whose parents did not understand them were preparing to go off to Vietnam. One young woman wrote a good deal about the moon and her menstrual cycle. In these poems, the moon always appeared as THM'N, the moon. She could not explain just why this had to be, but we all kind of felt it. The moon. Yeah, dig it, sister. I brought poems of my own to class, but back in my dorm room was my dirty little secret, the half-completed manuscript of a novel about a teenage gang's plan to start a race riot. They would use this for cover while ripping off 24 loan-sharking operations and illegal drug rings in the city of Harding, my fictional version of Detroit. I had never been within 600 miles of Detroit, but I didn't let that stop or even slow me down. This novel, Sword in the Darkness, seemed very tawdry to me when compared to what my fellow students were trying to achieve, which is why, I suppose, I never brought any of it to class for a critique. The fact that it was also better and somehow truer than all my poems about sexual yearning and post-adolescent angst only made things worse. The result was a four-month period in which I could write almost nothing at all. What I did instead was drink beer, smoke Pall Malls, read John D. MacDonald paperbacks, and watch afternoon soap operas. Writing courses and seminars do offer at least one undeniable benefit. In them, the desire to write fiction or poetry is taken seriously. For aspiring writers who have been looked upon with pitying condescension by their friends and relatives, "You better not quit your day job just yet," is a popular line, usually delivered with a hideous Bob's your uncle grin. This is a wonderful thing. In writing classes, if nowhere else, it is entirely permissible to spend large chunks of your time off in your own little dream world. Still, do you really need permission and a hall pass to go there? Do you need someone to make you a paper badge with the word writer on it before you believe you are one? God, I hope not. Another argument in favor of writing courses has to do with the men and women who teach them. There are thousands of talented writers at work in America, and only a few of them, I think the number might be as low as 5%, can support their families and themselves with their work. There's always some grant money available, but it's never enough to go around. As for government subsidies for creative writers, perish the thought. Tobacco subsidies, sure. Research grants to study the motility of unpreserved bull sperm, of course. Creative writing subsidies, never. Most voters would agree, I think. With the exception of Norman Rockwell and Robert Frost, America has never much revered her creative people. As a whole, we're more interested in commemorative plates from the Franklin Mint and internet greeting cards. And if you don't like it, it's a case of tough titty said the kitty, because that's just the way things are. Americans are a lot more interested in TV quiz shows than in the short fiction of Raymond Carver. The solution for a good many underpaid creative writers is to teach what they know to others. This can be a nice thing, and it's nice when beginning writers have a chance to meet with and listen to veteran writers they may have long admired. It's also great when writing classes lead to business contacts. I got my first agent, Maurice Crane, courtesy of my sophomore comp teacher, the noted regional short story writer Edwin M. Holmes. After reading a couple of my stories in E.H. 77, a comp class emphasizing fiction, Professor Holmes asked Crane if he would look at a selection of my work. Crane agreed, but we never had much of an association. He was in his 80s, unwell, and died shortly after our first correspondence. I can only hope it wasn't my initial batch of stories that killed him. You don't need writing classes or seminars any more than you need this or any other book on writing. Faulkner learned his trade while working in the Oxford, Mississippi post office. Other writers have learned the basics while serving in the Navy, working in steel mills, or doing time in America's finer crossbar hotels. I learned the most valuable and commercial part of my life's work while washing motel sheets and restaurant tablecloths at the New Franklin Laundry in Bangor. You learn best by reading a lot and writing a lot, and the most valuable lessons of all are the ones you teach yourself. These lessons almost always occur with the study door closed. Writing class discussions can often be intellectually stimulating and great fun, but they also often stray far afield from the actual nuts and bolts business of writing. Still, I suppose you might end up in a version of that Sylvan writer's colony in East is East, your own little cottage in the pines, complete with word processor, fresh disks. What is so delicately exciting to the imagination as a box of fresh computer disks or a ream of blank paper? The cot in the other room for that afternoon nap, and the lady who tiptoes to your stoop, leaves your lunch, and then tiptoes away again. That would be okay, I guess. If you got a chance to participate in a deal like that, I'd say go right ahead. You might not learn the magic secrets of writing. There aren't any. Bummer, huh? But it would certainly be a grand time, and grand times are something I'm always in favor of. Other than where do you get your ideas, the question any publishing writer hears most frequently from those who want to publish are, how do you get an agent, and how do you make contact with people in the world of publishing? The tone in which these questions are asked is often bewildered, sometimes chagrined, and frequently angry. There is a commonly held suspicion that most newcomers who actually succeed in getting their books published broke through because they had an in, a contact, a rabbi in the business. The underlying assumption is that publishing is just one big, happy, incestuously closed family. It's not true. Neither is it true that agents are a snooty, superior bunch that would die before allowing their ungloved fingers to touch an unsolicited manuscript. Well, okay, yeah, there are a few like that. The fact is that agents, publishers, and editors are all looking for the next hot writer who can sell a lot of books and make lots of money. And not just the next hot young writer either. Helen Santmeyer was in a retirement home when she published And the Ladies of the Club. Frank McCourt was quite a bit younger when he published Angela's Ashes, but he's still no spring chicken. As a young man just beginning to publish some short fiction in the TNA magazines, I was fairly optimistic about my chances of getting published. I knew that I had some game, as the basketball players say these days, and I also felt that time was on my side. Sooner or later, the best-selling writers of the 60s and 70s would either die or go senile, making room for newcomers like me. Still, I was aware that I had worlds to conquer beyond the pages of Cavalier, Gent, and Jugs. I wanted my stories to find the right markets, and that meant finding a way around the troubling fact that a good many of the best-paying ones, Cosmopolitan, for instance, which at that time published lots of short stories, wouldn't look at unsolicited fiction. The answer, it seemed to me, was to have an agent. If my fiction was good, I thought in my unsophisticated but not entirely illogical way, an agent would solve all my problems. I didn't discover until much later that not all agents are good agents, and that a good agent is useful in many other ways than getting the fiction editor at Cosmo to look at your short stories. But as a young man, I did not yet realize that there are people in the publishing world, more than a few actually, who would steal the pennies off a dead man's eyes. For me, that didn't really matter, because before my first couple of novels actually succeeded in finding an audience, I had little to steal. You should have an agent, and if your work is saleable, you will have only a moderate amount of trouble finding one. You will probably be able to find one even if your work isn't saleable, as long as it shows promise. Sports agents represent minor leaguers who are basically playing for meal money in hopes that their young clients will make it to the bigs. For the same reason, literary agents are often willing to handle writers with only a few publishing credits. You'll very likely find someone to handle your work, even if your publishing credits are limited strictly to the little magazines, which pay only in copies. These magazines are often regarded by agents and book publishers as proving grounds for new talent. You must begin as your own advocate, which means reading the magazines, publishing the kind of stuff you write. You should also pick up the writer's journals and buy a copy of Writer's Market, the most valuable of tools for the writer new to the marketplace. If you're really poor, ask someone to give it to you for Christmas. Both the mags and Writer's Market, it's a whopper of a volume, but reasonably priced, list book and magazine publishers and include thumbnail descriptions of the sort of stories each market uses. You'll also find the most saleable lengths and the names of editorial staffs. As a beginning writer, you'll be most interested in the little magazines if you're writing short stories. If you're writing or have written a novel, you'll want to note the lists of literary agents in the writing magazines and in Writer's Market. You may also want to add a copy of the LMP, Literary Marketplace, to your reference shelf. You need to be canny, careful, and assiduous in your search for an agent or a publisher, but this bears repeating, the most important thing you can do for yourself is read the market. Looking at the thumbnail rundowns in Writer's Digest may help. Publishes mostly mainstream fiction, 2,000 to 4,000 words, steer clear of stereotyped characters and hackneyed romance situations. But a thumbnail is, leave us face it, just a thumbnail. Submitting stories without first reading the market is like playing darts in a dark room. You might hit the target every now and then, but you don't deserve to. Here is the story of an aspiring writer I'll call Frank. Frank is actually a composite of three young writers I know, two men and one woman. All have enjoyed some success in their 20s as writers. None, as of this writing, are driving Rolls Royces. All three will probably break through, which is to say that by the age of 40, I believe all three will be publishing regularly, and probably one will have a drinking problem. The three faces of Frank all have different interests and write in different styles and voices, but their approaches to the hurdles between them and becoming published writers are similar enough for me to feel comfortable about putting them together. I also feel that other beginning writers, you, for instance, dear reader, could do worse than follow in Frank's footsteps. Frank was an English major. You don't have to be an English major to become a writer, but it sure doesn't hurt. Who began submitting his stories to magazines as a college student. He took several creative writing courses, and many of the magazines to which he made submissions were recommended to him by his creative writing teachers. Recommended or not, Frank carefully read the stories in each magazine and submitted his own stories according to his sense of where each would fit best. For 3 years, I read every story magazine published, he says, then laughs. I may be the only person in America who can make that statement. Careful reading or not, Frank didn't publish any stories in those markets while attending college, although he did publish half a dozen or so in the campus literary magazine. We'll call it the Quarterly Pretension. He received personal notes of rejection from readers at several of the magazines to which he submitted, including Story, the female version of Frank said, "They owed me a note," and the Georgia Review. During this time, Frank subscribed to Writer's Digest and The Writer, reading them carefully and paying attention to articles about agents and the accompanying agency lists. He circled the names of several who mentioned literary interests he felt he shared. Frank took particular note of agents who talked about liking stories of high conflict, an arty way of saying suspense stories. Frank is attracted to suspense stories, also to stories of crime and the supernatural. A year out of college, Frank gets his first acceptance letter, Oh, Happy Day. It is from a little magazine available at a few newsstands, but mostly by subscription. Let's call it King Snake. The editor offers to buy Frank's 1,200-word vignette, The Lady in the Trunk, for $25 plus a dozen CCs, contributor's copies. Frank is, of course, delirious, way past cloud nine. All the relatives get a call, even the ones he doesn't like, especially the ones he doesn't like, is my guess. $25 won't pay the rent, won't even buy a week's worth of groceries for Frank and his wife, but it's a validation of his ambition, and that, any newly published writer would agree, I think, is priceless. Someone wants something I did. Yippee! Nor is that the only benefit. It is a credit, a small snowball, which Frank will now begin rolling downhill, hoping to turn it into a snow boulder by the time it gets to the bottom. 6 months later, Frank sells another story to a magazine called Lodgepine Review. Like Kingsnake, Lodgepine is a composite. Only sell is probably too strong a word. Proposed payment for Frank's Two Kinds of Men is 25 contributor's copies. Still, it's another credit. Frank signs the acceptance form, loving that line beneath the blank for his signature almost to death, proprietor of the work, by God, and sends it back the following day. Tragedy strikes a month later. It comes in the form of a form letter, the salutation of which reads, Dear Lodgepine Review Contributor. Frank reads it with a sinking heart. A grant was not renewed, and Lodgepine Review has gone to that great writer's workshop in the sky. The forthcoming summer issue will be the last. Frank's story, unfortunately, was slated for fall. The letter closes by wishing Frank good luck in placing his story elsewhere. In the lower left-hand corner, someone has scribbled four words, Awfully sorry about this. Frank is awfully sorry, too. After getting loaded on cheap wine and waking up with cheap wine hangovers, he and his wife are sorrier still. But his disappointment doesn't prevent him from getting his almost-published story right back into circulation. At this point, he has half a dozen of them making the rounds. He keeps a careful record of where they have been and what sort of response they got during their visit at each stop. He also keeps track of magazines where he has established some sort of personal contact, even if that contact consists of nothing but two scribbled lines and a coffee stain. A month after the bad news about Lodgepine Review, Frank gets some very good news. It arrives in a letter from a man he's never heard of. This fellow is the editor of a brand new little magazine called Jackdaw. He is now soliciting stories for the first issue, and an old school friend of his, editor of the recently defunct Lodgepine Review, as a matter of fact, mentioned Frank's canceled story. If Frank hasn't placed it, the Jackdaw editor would certainly like a look. No promises, but Frank doesn't need promises. Like most beginning writers, all he needs is a little encouragement and an unlimited supply of takeout pizza. He mails the story off with a letter of thanks, and a letter of thanks to the ex-Lodgepine editor, of course. 6 months later, Two Kinds of Men appears in the premiere issue of Jackdaw. The Old Boy Network, which plays as large a part in publishing as it does in many other white-collar, pink-collar businesses, has triumphed again. Frank's pay for this story is $15, 10 contributors' copies, and another all-important credit. In the next year, Frank lands a job teaching high school English. Although he finds it extremely difficult to teach literature and correct student themes in the daytime and then work on his own stuff at night, he continues to do so, writing new short stories and getting them into circulation, collecting rejection slips and occasionally retiring stories he sent to all the places he can think of. "They'll look good in my collection when it finally comes out," he tells his wife. Our hero has also picked up a second job writing book and film reviews for a newspaper in a nearby city. He's a busy, busy boy. Nevertheless, in the back of his mind, he has begun to think about writing a novel. When asked what is the most important thing for a young writer who's just beginning to submit his or her fiction to remember, Frank pauses only a few seconds before replying, "Good presentation." "Say what?" He nods. "Good presentation, absolutely. When you send your story out, there ought to be a very brief cover letter on top of the script telling the editor where you've published other stories and just a line or two on what this one's about. And you should close by thanking him for the reading. That's especially important. You should submit on a good grade of white bond paper, none of that slippery erasable stuff. Your copy should be double-spaced, and on the first page, you should put your address in the upper left-hand corner. It doesn't hurt to include your telephone number, too. In the right-hand corner, put an approximate word count." Frank pauses, laughs, and says, "Don't cheat, either. Most magazine editors can tell how long a story is just by looking at the print and riffling the pages." I'm still a bit surprised at Frank's answer. I expected something that was a little less nuts and bolts. "Nah," he says, "you get practical in a hurry once you're out of school and trying to find a place for yourself in the business. The very first thing I learned was that you don't get any kind of a hearing at all unless you go in looking like a professional." Something in his tone makes me think he believes I've forgotten a lot about how tough things are at the entry level, and perhaps he's right. It's been almost 40 years since I had a stack of rejection slips pinned to a spike in my bedroom, after all. "You can't make them like your story," Frank finishes, "but you can at least make it easy for them to try to like it." As I write this, Frank's own story is still a work in progress, but his future looks bright. He has published a total of 6 shorts now and won a fairly prestigious prize for one of them. We'll call it the Minnesota Young Writers Award, although no part of my Frank composite actually lives in Minnesota. The cash prize was $500, by far his biggest paycheck for a story. He has begun work on his novel, and when it's finished, in the early spring of 2001, he estimates, a reputable young agent named Richard Chams, also a pseudonym, has agreed to handle it for him. Frank got serious about finding an agent at about the same time he got serious about his novel. "I didn't want to put in all that work and then be faced with not knowing how to sell the damn thing when I was done," he told me. Based on his explorations of the literary marketplace and the lists of agents in Writer's Market, Frank wrote an even dozen letters, each exactly the same except for the salutation. Here's the template. June 19th, 1999. Dear blank. "I am a young writer, 28 years old, in search of an agent. I got your name in a Writer's Digest article titled Agents of the New Wave and thought we might fit each other. I have published 6 short stories since getting serious about my craft. They are The Lady in the Trunk, Kingsnake, Winter 1996, $25 plus copies. Two Kinds of Men, Jackdaw, Summer 1997, $15 plus copies. Christmas Smoke, Mystery Quarterly, Fall 1997, $35. Big Thumps, Charlie Takes His Lumps, Cemetery Dance, January-February 1998, $50 plus copies. 60 Sneakers, Pucker Brush Review, April and May, 1998, copies. A Long Walk in These Year Woods, Minnesota Review, Winter, 1998-1999, $70 plus copies. I would be happy to send any of these stories, or any of the half dozen or so I'm currently flogging around, for you to look at if you'd like. I'm particularly fond of A Long Walk in These Year Woods, which won the Minnesota Young Writers Award. The plaque looks good on our living room wall, and the prize money, $500, looked excellent for the week or so it was actually in our bank account. I have been married 4 years. My wife Marjorie and I teach school. The reason I'm seeking representation now is that I'm at work on a novel. It's a suspense story about a man who gets arrested for a series of murders which occurred in his little town 20 years before. The first 80 pages or so in pretty good shape, and I'd also be delighted to show you these. Please be in touch and tell me if you'd like to see some of my material. In the meantime, thank you for taking the time to read my letter. Sincerely yours, blank. Frank included his telephone number as well as his address, and one of his target agents, not Richard Chams, actually called to chat. Three wrote back asking to look at the prize-winning story about the hunter lost in the woods. Half a dozen asked to see the first 80 pages of his novel. The response was big, in other words. Only one agent to whom he wrote expressed no interest in Frank's work, citing a full roster of clients. Yet outside of his slight acquaintances in the world of the little magazines, Frank knows absolutely nobody in the publishing business, has not a single personal contact. It was amazing, he says, absolutely amazing. I expected to take whoever wanted to take me, if anybody did, and count myself lucky. Instead, I got to pick and choose. He puts down his bumper crop of possible agents to several things. First, the letter he sent around was literate and well-spoken. It took 4 drafts and 2 arguments with my wife to get that casual tone just right, Frank says. Second, he could supply an actual list of published short stories, and a fairly substantial one. No big money, but the magazines were reputable. Third, there was the prize winner. Frank thinks that may have been key. I don't know if it was or not, but it certainly didn't hurt. Frank was also intelligent enough to ask Richard Chams and all the other agents he queried for a list of their bona fides. Not a list of clients. I don't know if an agent who gave out the names of his clients would even be ethical. But a list of the publishers to whom the agent had sold books and the magazines to which he had sold short stories. It's easy to con a writer who's desperate for representation. Beginning writers need to remember that anyone with a few $100 to invest can place an ad in Writer's Digest, calling himself or herself a literary agent. It isn't as if you have to pass a bar exam or anything. You should be especially wary of agents who promise to read your work for a fee. A few such agents are reputable. The Scott Meredith Agency used to read for fees. I don't know if they still do or not. But all too many are unscrupulous fucks. I'd suggest that if you're that anxious to get published, you skip agent hunting or query letters to publishers and go directly to a vanity press. There you will at least get a semblance of your money's worth. We're nearly finished. I doubt if I've covered everything you need to know to become a better writer, and I'm sure I haven't answered all your questions, but I have talked about those aspects of the writing life which I can discuss with at least some confidence. I must tell you, though, that confidence during the actual writing of this book was a commodity in remarkably short supply. What I was long on was physical pain and self-doubt. When I proposed the idea of a book on writing to my publisher at Scribner, I felt that I knew a great deal about the subject. My head all but burst with the different things I wanted to say. And perhaps I do know a lot, but some of it turned out to be dull, and most of the rest, I've discovered, has more to do with instinct than with anything resembling higher thought. I found the act of articulating those instinctive truths painfully difficult. Also, something happened halfway through the writing of On Writing. A life changer, as they say. I'll tell you about it presently. For now, just please know that I did the best I could. One more matter needs to be discussed, a matter that bears directly on that life changer, and one I've touched on already, but indirectly. Now, I'd like to face it head on. It's a question that people ask in different ways. Sometimes it comes out polite and sometimes it comes out rough, but it always amounts to the same. Do you do it for the money, honey? The answer is no. Don't now and never did. Yes, I've made a great deal of dough from my fiction, but I never set a single word down on paper with the thought of being paid for it. I have done some work as favors for friends, log rolling is the slang term for it, but at the very worst, you'd have to call that a crude kind of barter. I have written because it fulfilled me. Maybe it paid off the mortgage on the house and got the kids through college, but those things were on the side. I did it for the buzz. I did it for the pure joy of the thing. And if you can do it for joy, you can do it forever. There have been times when, for me, the act of writing has been a little act of faith, a spit in the eye of despair. The second half of this book was written in that spirit. I gutted it out, as we used to say when we were kids. Writing is not life, but I think that sometimes it can be a way back to life. That was something I found out in the summer of 1999, when a man driving a blue van almost killed me.